is Bob Fitrakis on Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, The Green Renaissance on 94.1 FM and WCRS 92.7 and 98.3 FM. Today we have a special guest, Lee Camp, so stick around and hit our YouTube channel's like and subscribe button, and we'll see you on the other side of the news.
Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
Lee Camp, a prolific social and political comedian who has been compared to Jon Stewart, George Carlin, and Lenny Bruce. His biting commentary and sharp wit slices up the partisan politics of our day. He skillfully threads into his signature cathartic rants a tone that leaves his audience with a feeling of relief and solidarity, and I'd also say hope. And they're not the only ones that feel that way. I feel that way whenever I talk to Lee Camp. He's the host and head writer at the show Redacted Tonight on RT and a contributor at Truthdig and Consortium News. He's also got a couple of amazing podcasts, Common Censored with Eleanor Goldfield and Moment of Clarity, which was the title of his first YouTube show and book. But now he's got a new book out titled Bullet Points and Punchlines, the most important commentary ever written on the epic American tragicomedy, with an introduction by Jimmy Dore and a foreword by Chris Hedges. It's so great to have you back, Lee. Did I leave anything out?
Thanks for having me. No, you got most of it. I also hold the record for eating the most hard cheeses while standing on one leg. So if you could put that in next time around.
Now, is that real accomplishment? I never know with you. It's because virtually everything you say is actually factual. It just seems like it's not true or absurd.
Good to be here, Bob.
Really, you're one of the best fact-based reporters. And we've seen this commentary. I saw some reviewers likened your book to Hunter S. Thompson. You do have a certain gonzo style. And what are these bullet points at this bizarre moment in history, which is a tragicomedy, right? We saw the tragedy. I like to think, from my perspective, that was either Nixon or most likely Reagan. And now we're seeing, of course, the farce that really does come across as comedy. It's absurd. It's like we've been stuck in some surreal drama that can't possibly be real. When I wake up in the morning, I'm going, how is this happening? And why is he chronically and massively lying again as president?
Yeah, no, you're right. It actually makes my job incredibly difficult that reality has lapped satire. When you have a president telling people that maybe they should inject bleach into their system, it really makes my job difficult. So that is one thing that I begrudge Donald Trump for, making it so hard to make things any funnier than he already makes them. But in terms of what the bullet points are in the book, you know, it did come out just before this pandemic hit. But many of the stories in there, maybe all the stories, are still incredibly important. It covers the $21 trillion of unaccounted for adjustments that are listed in the Pentagon's own budgets. It covers the 100,000 whistleblower complaints that the Pentagon says itself that they have received over the past several years, and almost all of those have been entirely just suppressed, covered up, and not actually investigated. It covers our economic war on Venezuela, which the latest numbers show have killed probably 100,000 people in that country. It covers a lot of things. And I throw in the humor in there in the book as well, because some of these things are hard to stomach. It's hard to sit there and read about this with your morning cereal. So I try to get the comedy in there as well. You need a little dessert with the medicine, or else you'll drive your car off a bridge. So,
well, when you're looking at these bullet points, how does or what is the key bullet point when we look at the American two-party system and how this whole primary played out in the middle of a pandemic, and whether there was any real debate that would have fundamentally changed the structure of power in America?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key bullet point is that the Democratic Party was far more concerned with defeating Bernie Sanders, keeping at bay any possible progressive movement in the party, than they were concerned with beating Donald Trump. They put forward one of the weakest, senile candidates with a history of racist policies, such as the drug laws that have locked up millions of Americans, sexual assault accusations against him. It really is just the most losingest candidate that they could put forward. But, a close second to that bullet point for our elections and this primary elections was how similar they were to 2016 and how our voting systems, our electoral systems have not been changed. The DNC did almost nothing to try and deal with the problems and the rigging and the manipulation that went on in 2016 and that you've been so effectively covering for years now. It really just all happened again. You closed polling places in the areas with Hispanic people and Black people in Texas in order to minimize Bernie Sanders' win there. You have people forced onto provisional ballots by the hundreds of thousands in California in order to minimize Bernie Sanders' win there. You have, of course, the crazy shadow app in Iowa that just popped up 2 months before the election and suddenly created by former Clinton staffers and is a complete disaster, but it seems an intentional disaster. And anyway, you can go on, but our electoral system is far more hilarious than any joke I can come up for it.
I think a plus, one of the pluses is Trump now openly talks about voter suppression, right? It's no longer something you hide, right?
The guy who has stood by while the Republican Party has purged 17 million Americans just due to so-called residency changes that haven't really actually happened, that's the guy who's worried about voter suppression. The guy who had tried to make interstate cross-check a national game of purging people of color from the voter rolls. That's the guy you really want worried about voter suppression.
Well, in voting, we had this in Ohio. I mean, there's three options in a pandemic on mail-in voting, right? One, which is the logical one, if you believed in democracy, you send everyone a ballot who's a registered voter. The other one is you send them an application, which they send through the mail and hope they get a ballot back. And the third one is you leave it up to people in a pandemic with, boards of elections closed everywhere, and they just hope, as in Ohio, the most likely place, there's only one board of election in each county, and it's not really on a bus line here in the capital where most people live, but the only place where you can really find one of these applications, they said, was Kroger's at the grocery store.
Yeah.
Literally at the service managers, you had to go to see the service desk and the manager there and could give you an application because government was closed down.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people are going to walk miles during a work day to go get an application to vote between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. two of the least desirable candidates ever. Something tells me people aren't going to make that trek.
Yeah, the It's clear. I mean, they're running someone they know is cognitively impaired. I mean, reports are they joke about it. You know, we'll schedule them early in the morning. I mean, how would the world at such a moment, such a grave threat to the planet from Trump, you come up, as you've pointed out, with the weakest candidate possible? Is that just endemic to the system? Is there something so fundamentally corrupt and broken about this system that, of course, that's who you're going to get as the alternative?
Well, it goes back to them not caring whether they lose to Trump as much as they cared about beating Bernie Sanders. They didn't really care what kind of candidate ultimately got that position as long as he stood for the corporate state. And so the reason they're fine with Trump winning re-election is because the things they claim to be upset about with Trump, the so-called resistance, are surface area things. They're upset that he said this or tweeted that. They're upset that he fired this person or, did something that was against protocol. That's what they're acting like, the big shames of Donald Trump. Meanwhile, they're fine with the ongoing endless wars of our military-industrial complex. Donald Trump has made Wall Street as unfettered as ever, the big banks as unfettered as ever. He's done nothing about the prison-industrial complex. So, as long as he stays out of the way of those areas, of those core issues of American empire, then they're largely okay with him still being in that position. Their only worry and their dislike for him is really just that he might not be a good enough steward of the American empire. He might make it look bad and hasten its end in this late-stage capitalism. But that's a small concern compared to beating back the progressive ideas of Bernie Sanders, beating back Medicare for All, beating back living wage, beating back, an end to the wars, the 1,000 military bases around the world. Those are the real concerns of our wealthy elites that run the country.
And what are some of these bullet points in the new book? It seems like the overall theme is obvious. It's a corporatist state, increasingly corrupt, clearly a kleptocracy. It's, open looting, the $21 million, $21
trillion. $21 million they spend in a weekend.
Yeah, and I spent that while we were exchanging comments here on $21 trillion. So what else are some of the key bullet points in the new book?
Yeah, well, one of the most important ones, which I didn't know going in, would be this important and prescient. It's a story from 2 years ago, but the reason it's so important now is what it says about this pandemic. It's a story about an analyst note from Goldman Sachs. The top analyst at Goldman Sachs had written, and it leaked out. It was written to top investors. So we're talking some of the wealthiest people in the world at one of the biggest investment banks in the world, telling their investors not to invest in cures for diseases because, quote, there's not a good enough continuing revenue stream if you cure diseases. If someone pays for a one-time cure, that's not a good revenue stream for the investors. The person is cured and they don't keep paying. So basically, Goldman Sachs is saying, don't invest in cures, invest in treatments, because then you can keep collecting money from people who continue to be ill. And it's just the most horrific. It sounds like some sort of Dr. Evil plan. But they also say in that same note that there's a second problem with curing diseases, which is then the person is not contagious to give it to other people. They don't put those revenue streams further out into the population. If they're cured, they're not contagious. And so it basically is saying that Goldman Sachs has a profitable partnership with contagious disease. Now that I read that, it makes sense, because Lloyd Blankfein, the head of Goldman Sachs, does kind of look like gonorrhea. But it is incredibly just offensive that they would do this, that they would say this, that they would recommend people not invest in curing diseases that could help thousands, if not millions of people. And, you know, there's no direct connect. They didn't say this disease or that disease. So there's no direct connection to coronavirus, but coronaviruses have been around since the 60s or 70s. And this new novel version, COVID-19, is the one that's caused the pandemic. So who knows if our investment banks, the richest people in the world, had been investing in more cures rather than treatments. It's possible that that something could have helped with this pandemic. But, you know, that goes to show that our system is set up by sociopaths to seek profit over all else. And that is a chapter in the book that has proven incredibly important right now.
Well, this morning I was watching NBC News and they had a story on a possible vaccine and was going to save everything. And then during the end of the story, they said the vaccine does not prevent the virus. And I'm thinking, I thought that was the definition of vaccine. Exactly. Why are you touting this, you know, so-called vaccine if it doesn't cure or prevent?
Right. Right. And you know, the other thing is they keep saying, oh, this vaccine's going to be rushed onto the market in, you know, Trump saying January or something, which is completely unfeasible. The average vaccine takes 10 to 12 years. Even if they rush it, it could be a year. But do you really want a vaccine rushed onto the market? Vaccines can have huge impacts if they're not tested properly. So the idea that we should just rush it out and tell everyone to go get this injected into themselves is kind of horrifying.
Well, you may need to rush one after another and charge people over and over again.
yeah, get some more money from
the Gulf War. There was you know, tremendous amount of money made in England off some of the anthrax and the other vaccines, which ultimately were thought not to be real functional and may have been the cause of some of the Gulf War syndrome. But again, there's, you know, billions upon billions that can be made in various ways through these pandemics.
I think they should just market a pill for all of us that cures COVID-19, and it should just be called placebo. And they should just give it to everyone, and we'd be so happy, and we'd all go back to work, and we just take placebos.
Streaming to you from the Indie Media Studios of the Free Press Network here on YouTube, but also available online at WGRN.org. Plus, listen to us on Columbus, Ohio's two volunteer-run low-power FM radio stations, Fridays at 5:30 p.m. on WGRN 94.1, The Green Renaissance, and Mondays, 5:30 p.m. on WCRS 92.7 and 98.3.
One thing I was thinking about, your coverage of Jeffrey Epstein, who I don't know if you know this or not, but I wrote about Jeffrey Epstein some 25 years ago.
Really?
And, well, they're from, he lived in Columbus. Him and a man named Les Wendt, really? Of course.
What was he involved in back then?
Well, he was involved in, Wexner was involved in organized crime. I published the Shapiro murder file, which was a police document linking him as a money launderer for the Genovese LaRocca crime family, that his rolling stock. And they also were involved in a airline called Southern Air Transport, formerly Air America, which was known for guns and drugs. And they brought that, Jeff Epstein, working for Wexner, brought that to Columbus, Ohio. So that's how I hooked up when they brought in the Hassanfuss Iran-Contra drug and gun airline and said, who would bring this with government money, $25 million from the state, the Columbus. Wow. It turned out to be a guy I'd never heard of named Jeff Epstein.
So he moved from drugs and guns to the lighter work of pedophile flights.
The Lolita Express, which he bought that, he got that plane from the Limited. So there was some concern by law enforcement in Ohio that, and again, this stuff is so absurd that they were blackmailing people.
Nothing came of your reporting then, huh? They didn't, did it cause an investigation or anything?
Columbus, Ohio, right? The crazy guy writing for the alternative paper. So what's your take on Mr. Epstein's convenient death?
Yeah, it is highly convenient. I did a segment or two on it. I didn't get deeply into the weeds of all the connections of Ghislaine Maxwell and Mossad and everything. So, I didn't follow every tendril, but I do love that apparently he was, you know, in this prison. The prisoners nearby said they heard screaming, which, yes, of course you would scream if you just found out you were going to commit suicide. Then you've got both guards falling asleep simultaneously, which I guess, you know, people don't know this, but prison guards often like to take a nap together and cuddle together. They both fall asleep simultaneously. All the cameras that are connected to this area of the prison are all off or broken at that time. And then finally you have the fact that the coroner, who did rule it, I think initially as self-inflicted, said that the bones in the throat that were broken tend to only break with extreme strangling. They don't tend to break when you're hanging yourself, which is how you do it in a prison, with leaning against a sheet, because that's not a hard hit to the throat. It's a soft pressure on the windpipe. So he happened to break these bones that almost only actually break with strangulation or, you know, an extreme hanging where you drop 15 feet or something. So all of those things are pretty surprising.
How does this happen, right? The should have been the most protected man in America. So how do you feel about being compared to Hunter S. Thompson? Familiar with his work? Any conscious kind of gonzo sense of delivery?
I am. I do like his work, and of course, I find the comparison incredibly flattering. Of the people that were kind of influential on my writing and my comedy, I also am a stand-up comedian. I've been doing that for 20 years. Performed shows around the country and around the world. So, you know, many comedians were probably more influential on me than journalists or, you know, you could say Hunter S. Thompson was a comedic take on some forms of journalism. But, you know, people like George Carlin were probably more influential on me. But I do love Hunter S. Thompson's writing. Also a big David Foster Wallace fan. And you know, then there's the comedic activists that were also influential on me, like Abbie Hoffman and the Yes Men, that are creating activism but making it kind of fun and funny at the same time, just to kind of get through the malaise of boring standard politics. And I think what those people did is very impressive and important. And they all had a definite impact on me.
Yeah, so it doesn't surprise me. I worked a little with Abbie.
Did you?
And after he came back from the underground and was forming the Student Action Union. But and my favorite Yippie stories, Abbie was underground, but the Yippies were at the 10th anniversary of Kent State, and we were being clubbed, beaten, and tear gas, and, you know, we were trying to stop this gym from being built and have a memorial, and in the middle of it, a group of Yippies in gas masks came out line dancing like the Rockettes, and it did rattle. It was so absurd, and that type of humor is on your podcast, and comedy shows. What can you tell our listeners about accessing your podcast and comedy show? How can they get steady doses of Lee Camp?
Yeah, I do a free podcast called Common Censored with Eleanor Goldfield. Anyone can watch it anywhere they get their podcasts. And that's weekly. And, you know, we cover all the news similar to what you and I are talking about. And then the TV show Redacted Tonight and the interview show Redacted VIP, which I've had you on, and many others, John Perkins, Jill Stein, so many others. It's hard to list them all, but that is at, they can watch it on TV, but it's probably easiest to get at youtube.com/redactedtonight. And, you know, if they forget any of these things, where to find the book, where to find the The comedy special is another thing that just is free, stand-up comedy special. It's all at leecamp.com, LeeCamp.com is the easiest way to find me and all of my work.
And your book, the best way to buy it, where you get the most money in it, is how?
Yeah, so the way to go direct through the publisher, PM Press, which is a small independent publisher doing a lot of important works. So the best way to do that is go to leecampbook.com, because, you know, going through Amazon or whatever, they take a cut and it's not, you know, their workers are not treated well. So leecampbook.com or looking up PM Press is the best way to find it.
And you mentioned John Perkins, who I did some writing on it after he wrote on Gaddafi. I said, look, man, Gaddafi's got nothing to do with, the terrorist issue. It's all got to do with the gold dinar. him trying to come up with a pan-African currency. So here's one of the, leaders of the corporate capitalist world that suddenly began to confess. And he's giving us a totally different perspective that you can't find on mainstream media. You can only find on Lee Camp.
Yeah, and actually that is in the book about, why we took down Libya, and it's, connected to that and central banking, the fact that they were going around the petrodollar, Iraq dropped the dollar before their invasion, Syria dropped the dollar. Going around our central banking and trying to create your own currency is one of the number one reasons that we invade and topple countries and cause so much harm to so many millions of people.
And the take on Venezuela?
The chapter in the book about it is how, I never thought that the administration, the U.S. administration, would actually admit that the reason they want to topple Venezuela and basically put in a puppet government is to steal their oil. However, then you had John Bolton, when he was in the Trump administration, going on Fox News and saying, we really want to get in there and get their oil. So, that is something refreshing about the Trump administration. They don't seem to understand how to hide their motives. The U.S. wants that oil. They also want to upend the quote-unquote good example, as Noam Chomsky called it, the threat of the good example in Venezuela, the fact that they could have a more socialist government, nationalize the oil and give the profits to the people, is something that the U.S. very much wants to stop and prove that it can't work. But of course, the reason it's not working is because of us, because of our economic war on them. As I mentioned earlier, the estimates now are that 100,000 people have died in Venezuela from our economic war on them. So these are not bloodless battles when we wage economic war on these countries. Another example of the egregious harm done to indigenous is the Chevron oil spill, but really it's 20 years of an oil spill done intentionally in the indigenous areas of Ecuador. And right now they are trying to crush, Chevron is trying to crush the lawyer that won the suit against them. They owe billions of dollars to the indigenous in Ecuador, and they are trying to crush Stephen Donziger, if I'm pronouncing that right, the lawyer who won that case. They've got him on house arrest. They've got a corrupt judge, I believe in New York, making sure that he cannot leave his house. This is simply a lawyer who won a lawsuit against Chevron. I mean, it really is just a disgusting, egregious attack on the criminal justice system. Just the other day, 2 days ago, I think, 450 lawyers and human rights organizations printed an open letter in support of Donziger. So everyone should be calling Chevron to account for the harm they're doing.
All right, thanks, Lee Camp. We're out of time, but go out, my listeners, and buy Bullet Points and Punchlines, most important commentary ever written on the epic American tragicomedy. Thanks for being on the other side of the news, Lee.
Thank you so much, Bob. Keep fighting.
Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh!